Hello, this is The Thing About Cars. I'm Mickey Desai. Around the table today, we've got Becca.
Hello.
And Ben.
Hi.
And Dawn.
Hey there.
Excellent. And just we're going to jump right into this show with a moment of Grand Trivia Auto. So the question is, what was the first Japanese car to be produced in the United States? Was it the Toyota Camry, the Honda Civic, the Nissan Altima, the Honda Accord, or the Subaru WRX? So one of these was, you know, always made in Japan until one day they decided to move manufacturing to the U.S. And the choices again are Subaru WRX, the Honda Accord, the Nissan Altima, the Honda Civic, or the Toyota Camry. We'll come back to that at the end of the show.
And Datsun isn't an option.
A Nissan is on the list.
Yes.
Datsun being the precursor to Nissan.
I know. I'm splitting hairs here.
Yes, I know. Okay. First thing on our agenda for today is telemarketers.
Really?
Yeah, of all things. So, this is probably just a very short thing, but I keep getting calls. In fact, my wife has long since frequently gotten calls that say, it's time to extend your vehicle's, you know, extended coverage warranty.
Warranty. Oh, yes. Yeah. I constantly get those. I have yelled at them to take me off their list.
Right. Which is funny in my case, and especially in my wife's case, because her car is a 1992 Toyota Tercel with 200 something thousand miles on it. Mm-hmm. And she has started to simply tell them, hey, this is my car. Are you sure you want to warranty it? And then they almost always hang up the phone. And so it's like, okay, we thought, you know, it's like the telemarketers are like, hey, your car is due for this. Really? Do you know about my car? So
is it on your cell phone?
Is what on the cell phone?
Is this where the calls are coming to your cell phone or a landline?
Yeah, okay. Occasionally they'll come to the actual cell phone. Yeah, that's right.
Well, you know, the Supreme Court and others have upheld that robocalls are not supposed to be happening to cell phones. And you can get them in trouble if you can get the information, keep them on the phone and bug them, and then turn them into the FCC.
Well, see, now I've tried reporting people on the do not call registry and the report a call type thing. And I have been getting messages that say we no longer respond to individual things unless a certain number of complaints have been reached.
Right.
That it became such an issue that they had to scale back how much they were actually investigating or following up on.
They also can't really do anything if they're coming from outside the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
That is true.
I think any legislator could handily win their next election if they could tackle this issue for the American public instead of hiding beside the First Amendment on this one, because nobody in the world wants telemarketers to be able to have the right to interrupt me on my phone in the middle of my day, right? I mean, and yet what's happening is telemarketing is allowed because we cannot infringe their freedom of speech, never mind the consumer, you know.
But I'm still wondering, though, that's via phone. I mean, anybody's freedom of speech does not force everyone to listen. And I feel that's kind of what calling somebody is. Well, so
that's the logic, right? If someone shows up to your door and tries to give you a sales pitch, you can always shut the door on your phone. You can simply hang it up. And that's where they leave it.
I don't know. I don't find that to be First Amendment, but this is not a political podcast, so we won't go down there. On a different note, then, I will say maybe we ought to mess with them and see if one of them wants to warranty the Pontiac.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
It only needs a new engine.
Well, I've got a couple different thoughts here, and one is, you know, if sorry, my brain is completely derailed and spun out and it's sitting in a ditch, just sitting there smoking for some weird reason. But one thought is, you know, we're talking telemarketers here. And if these people wanted to legitimize their business, they wouldn't use those tactics to sell their stuff, you know?
Right.
And yeah, you know, there may be people out there who could legitimately benefit from having an extended warranty on their car, but set it up as an actual business and not some sort of trashy telemarketer technique.
Well, it's interesting that I think really what these are scammers. I don't think they're legitimate businesses.
No, what that's they're looking kinda how I, yeah.
is your social security number, your bank account, and they're going to scam you. They're not legit.
Right.
Right. That was pretty much my view as well. That's what I figured.
Yeah. So if I can figure out why I spun out a second ago, we'll come back and revisit that topic. But that was the thing about telemarketers. It's like, you know, extended car warranties. Well, that's that in itself is a whole separate topic. Never mind the method of delivery. I have never been interested in buying an extended warranty for a car. What about you guys?
No.
I actually had bought one on the planet. It's a very long story, but the people that were covering the extended warranty, and I purchased it when I purchased the vehicle, they were ruined the day they ever saw me.
Nice.
And I'm still mad because what happened should have been covered under it. It's a very long, convoluted story, like I said. So it actually saved my butt. But it was not one of those, somebody called me and offered it. It was available when I purchased the vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah. We bought an extended warranty on a Dodge Durango that was relatively new because they had just came back out. Like the Durango was gone for a few years. Mm-hmm. And we thought, maybe we should be cautious because they got to get some bugs out of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the other thing. If you're an early adopter, which I try not to be, I never buy the first year model of anything when it comes out. But maybe that's a good reason to buy an extended warranty if you're going to do that. But yeah, I'm with Ben. I don't see the need for extended warranties. In fact, Consumer Reports has repeatedly said, and by and large, an extended warranty is not worth it, no matter what you're buying, whether it's a car or a toaster.
Yep. It does. It's one of those things where you're trying to, I think the last one we were haggling with the salesperson and they said, hey, we'll throw in this extended warranty for $500. And I was like, oh, okay. So yeah, sometimes it's a negotiating point.
Sure.
Which actually brings my thought about just going back to the telemarketing. We've had our local Dodge continually call us about replacing that Dodge Durango that was totaled. And my husband always says, you know, the car was totaled. They're like, how are you liking your Dodge? It's like, it's in a junk heap. It's like, we'd have liked it if, you know, this idiot didn't come and literally total my car. So they were trying the other day, the salesperson said to Chris, hey, you know, I got this beautiful 2019, 9,000 miles on it, $25,000 for this Dodge Durango. Chris said, great, send me some pictures. Haven't heard from him.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, that's the huge disconnect, right? The Honda dealership that I took my current Honda to get the recall fixed, there's an airbag recall on it. You know, there's that whole saga that we talked about on the show before. I told them when I pulled in the first time, I said, I'm just here for the recall. Please don't touch any other part of the car. And 2 hours later, they said, you need new brakes. You need new this, you need everything. And long story becomes longer when I'm on the phone repeatedly with Honda corporate saying, what the hell are you people doing? And oh, by the way, you still haven't verified that the recall itself has been done. And again, that's all past history on the show. I don't want to rehash it at this point because they couldn't verify that they had done the recall properly.
Nice.
In any case, all that's finished. You know, here I am. I've left them a bad review internally, and I left them a bad review externally. The internal corporate review was a bad one. I said, here are the problems with your system, and here's what I specifically asked them not to do, and they went ahead and did it. And I said as much publicly as well. And last week they said, your car is due for service. I'm like, really? Do you know how much I drive my car? Is there some way you think you are aware of how many miles I'm putting on the thing and that, you know, and that I would want to bring it to you for service anyway?
Nice.
never mind all the complaints that I had with you guys last time I saw you for a recall that didn't include service. So, you know, it's all a sales tactic and they kind of suck, but that's how they make their money, I guess.
Yeah.
The upsell. Yes.
Yeah. It's the upsell. That's right. Anyway, I had a larger rant going on with that, but let's speaking of problems with cars, Becca, what's up with the Jeep?
Well, I started having this intermittent issue. Pardon me while I get my words all confused here. And what it is the oil light will come on. And it has been increasing in frequency to the point where every time I start it, the oil light comes on, but then when I turn off the car and then turn it back on, it goes away. Now, I've already done all the beginning stuff. I've pulled the code, and it's that ugly PO522. So I've emptied the old oil, I flushed the system, and then put in new oil. So not just changed it, but just in case there were any contaminants build up, anything clogging in the works, decreasing the oil pressure, what have you, I changed that, the oil filter. I also changed the sensor that is supposed to be directly connected with the code, which is the oil pressure sensor switch low voltage code. I've changed that. I've inspected the wires. I haven't actually hooked it up to my my multimeter yet, which is really my only next step. I've gone through and checked the service manual, because anytime I own a car, I don't just go out and buy Chilton, Hayes, and things like that. I actually get those massive encyclopedia sets of the service manuals. My concern was, okay, are we looking at an oil pump issue? The service manuals say nothing about any of these codes potentially being the oil pump, but if anybody is having any deja vu, this is where the Pontiac started.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is your oil pressure within range?
I need to, okay, here's where you're going to laugh at me. I need to hook up. I do have a manual oil pressure tester. The majority of it is actually stuck to the Pontiac. It's a very long. Because it's in a terrible place. I had to actually buy a specialty adapter because, of course, the Pontiac couldn't use any of the 30 included in the kit. No, it needed a specialized that I had to order. And now I can't get it to come back out of the Pontiac's engine. So there it has sat. So I do need to do that. But I'm going through my service manuals, and I'm not even finding what they consider to be the normal range on that. So I need to do that, but I also need to actually do the multimeter to check, see, you know, is there a short somewhere along the line that I'm not seeing? I wouldn't think so, though. I mean, just with how it's being intermittent and increasing, I'm not feeling like it's aground. It's not so like it's going to jiggle faster.
My initial response here is to you is very out of sheer concern for you, Becca. Do you need an exorcist?
Yes. Is it from me or my cars? Because I have one car that has fully earned her name Angel. She puts up with so much of my crap, and she just runs and runs and runs. If it's not a Mustang, it's like they come here to die. And I don't know if it's me. I mean, wait.
So were saying that it comes on, but then it goes away when you restart it.
Yes. But, I mean, you would also have to know the computer system and how it's triggered. I mean, technically, it's supposed to send out 3 faults before the light is triggered. Okay, so what? I stop at 2 when I turn off a car, and then I hit the 3rd when I turn it on? I mean, I'm not seeing the logic and why it's now. It just, the past couple days, it started doing it every time I turn it on, and then I turn the car off and back on, and it resets. So I'm not sure what's going on there.
Well, it is a Jeep.
Well, and you know, this Jeep engine got high praises from everybody I talked to, including people that had worked for Chrysler for a long time. And it's killing me that this is the beginning of what happened to the Pontiac, and it's beyond frustrating.
Could the sensor have gone bad?
That was on my list of things I've already done.
Because that isn't that so.
We don't need to pull the pan off and get up in there, do we?
I hope not. Well, you know what though? At least the pan would be easier. The problem is, and my big argument, the labor hours, if you go by the book on the Pontiac, to drop the oil pan 17 hours.
Oh, wow. Geez.
The Mustang is like 17 minutes, right? To drop the oil pan. The Pontiac was 17 hours. And that was part of my big hang up. Plus, you had to lift the engine to do it, remove half the steering and suspension.
Oh,
and,
boy.
And that would have been a disqualifying feature for me right there.
Which Jeep do you have? Which
one? I have the V6 3.7 Liberty 4x4.
Okay.
So if any listener has had a run-in and it is not the sensor, not the oil or the oil filter, or I have a couple more things that I can investigate, but I feel like I don't know. Bizarre. If anybody's had, I'm sorry?
Bizarre, very bizarre.
Very bizarre. And I'm having the worst case of deja vu. And I just, no more. Please, no.
Well, you know, this could just be an isolated thing, Becca. There's nothing that says it's going to turn into another huge electrical nightmare like it happened with the G8.
Oh, well, that was an electrical.
Oh. So I had to Google it, and there's a lot about the Liberty oil pressure sensor.
Ooh. By most everything that's on there ends up being the actual sensor itself.
Mm-hmm.
Most everything. So I did see one place where a dealership had recommended the oil pump be changed, which was part of my concern. But then the guy, as he goes through his story, says changing the oil pump only cost me a lot of money. It didn't fix the problem. So I should really look up TSB, shouldn't I?
Yes. Keep us posted and let us know what you find out.
Yeah, and I'm doing a search on the TSB at the moment.
Okay.
So moving on to happier stories and greener pastures.
Well, I mean, maybe it's time to test drive something different, Becca.
If you even suggest that Mach-E, I will...
nice.
You doesn't say you have to buy it. You can just try it.
Exactly.
Did you see the starting price tag on that thing?
I think it was 48.
Yeah, it was like 43. So I don't know.
You know, I bet if they took the Mustang badge off it, it would drop about $5,000 to $10,000 in price.
See? But, yeah.
But anyway, so speaking of test driving cars, I think, Don, you mentioned that there's some things on the 2021 list that you want to test drive, or did we
frame that in a different way? Yeah, well, I mean, any of these, that the new Mercedes GLA with the AMG on it, the convertible Lexus is interesting.
Yeah.
And there's just tons of, interesting new vehicles out there. Not just the new look, but I wonder what the feel is, like the road feel.
Yep.
On some of these. So
I wonder if there's a Hellcat Durango on that list.
Mm.
I've heard rumors about them taking a Durango and, putting a super powered Hemi into it.
Yeah, I've heard that as well.
Don't tell my husband. He will want that car so bad. It's not even funny.
Right.
But yeah. Test driving. I just love test driving cars. I think, Ben, we and I were talking about test driving it when you rent a car.
Oh yeah.
And all of the joys of that, instead of just driving it off the lot, down the street, and then back, that just doesn't show anything.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's almost this weird ritual, right? You go to a lot, and they say, you want to test drive it? And you're like, yeah, sure. But you have to, it's like you have training wheels on the entire time. And, as I was saying before we started the recordings, I feel like I haven't done my job truly doing a test drive unless the salesman who's with me is gripping his seat in fear on the way home.
On the other hand, I would definitely take that crappy little test drive before I paid money to rent it, because then I'll at least get just a vague ballpark idea whether it's even minimally acceptable at all,
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's a good point, because I have gotten cars for rental and said, oh my God, why did I do that? This is miserable. That too, yeah.
Or sometimes you just have no choice. Like I've learned the hard way renting certain SUVs to go on family vacations with. And you have no choice. You take what they give you. And
well, that depends. I've got, what is it called? I've executive status or something with one of the companies. Yes, I rent from them a lot, but it doesn't take much to get into the club where you basically pick anything on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that not counting the fancy cars. Those are still an upgrade fee. But even just all the ones on the row that I can pick from, sometimes that works out pretty well, like the V8 convertible Mustang I got in Denver. But there are times when it doesn't as well, like the time in Chicago when basically it was, which Dodge Caravan would you like?
Right.
That was all they had that night that I came into Chicago. Oh, I could pick about any color, but they were all Dodge Caravans.
That's too funny.
Oh, and I have to go back to this first look. I'm sorry. I'm like I said, I'm car oogling. They have a Maybach GLS Mercedes on the list as one of the first. It's
let me guess. It's actually it's a $150,000 vehicle.
It's $200,000 starting price, but it doesn't look that different from a regular GL. I mean, I have a GL. This is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got a pretty paint job on it, but this is weird. It doesn't look anything different than a GL.
But see, even to be able to rent a car for a test drive, why am I now paying? I don't know. I don't like the idea of having to. I don't know what I'm saying, because on the one hand, a test drive is marginally useful. On the other hand, the kind of test drive that we do off the lot just doesn't seem that useful. I don't know. Maybe I've got this cognitive dissonance thing happening.
It makes for a good introduction.
Yeah.
To a car, you know, if you, like I was saying before, if you just want to know if it's minimally acceptable, if the seat feels okay and you've got enough headroom and, you know, whether or not just everything feels right in a brief glance, you know, just to narrow your field.
Yeah. I guess that's fair. All right. Well, there are things that I definitely want to test drive, but, you know, as we mentioned in another past episode, there's part of me that doesn't want to do a test drive until I'm able to afford the thing I'm test driving.
This Maybach has reclining seats in the back.
In the back?
Yeah, it's like the seats come up with like your. I think they even have massage. They got her for $200,000.
Good grief!
Oh my! I mean, this thing is crazy. I would actually. I think it would be fun to test drive this, even if I can't afford it.
It sounds like it should come with the 1970s era porn soundtrack in the back as well.
It's amazing. I mean, wow, look at these reclining seats. I wonder if they have Corinthian leather.
You know, I had to watch Deadpool the other day because of that.
I love Deadpool.
Too funny. All right, I got a question for you guys, and we're coming near the end of the program here, but real quick, have you ever heard about people putting extra borax in their oil?
No.
Nope.
Yeah.
So. No, and that makes me look strangely at you. Why would people do that?
Well, I mean, they already add it to oil anyway. Borax or borates in general are added to oils and lubricants. It's part of the whole detergent package that's in oils that you buy off the shelf these days anyway. But I've met one guy on Reddit who's a DIY nut, and he says that your car would benefit by adding more. So he's actually gone through this process where he's buying like borax related products and extracting the borates out of it and simply adding them to his oil. He says you can't just dump them in there. There's an actual process, but he says that his car actually drives better with the extra stuff in there. And I was just wondering if you heard anything about that. I'm tempted to ask him to come join me for a quick 5-minute segment and we can hear what he says and how he actually does it. But on the one hand, some of what he says makes sense. On the other hand, it's like, okay, if it were really good for cars, why aren't we doing it already?
And how in the world could you safeguard yourself against ruining your engine?
Right. Yeah, there are way too many variables at play here, and it's not like you're going to lose anything if you don't do it. I mean, oil as it comes out of the factory is pretty damn good these days, and there's a lot of very complex chemistry going on there with additives and things. You know, is what you're doing going to mess up the suspension of the ingredients that are already there, that sort of thing? All kinds of different trouble you can get into doing this.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's what I'm thinking. It's just like, okay, you know, especially with a newer engine, right? A more modern engine, I would never even dream of doing that. But hopefully we can get this gentleman to join us for like a quick 5-minute chat and we'll see what he has to say and see if any part of it is really testable and, you know,
yeah.
What he has to say. Mm. But that was the whole borax in the oil thing. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I wanted to talk about before we wrap this episode is this is something of a rhetorical question. How many of us are major Star Wars fans?
Yeah, I don't know about major, but I'm into it.
Yeah,
guilty.
So why are the only things in the world of Star Wars with wheels the Jawa Sandcrawler?
That's a really good question.
there's nothing else in the whole world of Star Wars that we've seen that actually runs on wheels. Everything else flies.
Didn't the Ewoks have a little two-wheeled cart or something?
That's a good question. I'll have to look that up again.
Although, if you want to, you know, break the suspension of disbelief and, you know, get behind the scenes on it, there was this one land speeder used in episode 4 that was based on an MG. It's for shots where you weren't going to see the bottom of the thing anyway.
Right. I mean, but you definitely have to look behind the curtain in order to see that.
Oh yeah. 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 This is not canon. Right.
I think the Jabbas are very primitive people. I don't think that they have the capacity for air travel yet.
What was that one though, when they were on, okay, this is one of the more original movies, with the Ewoks, wasn't Leia driving a 4x4, like a four-wheeler at one point?
Really? At the Ewoks?
Not that I recall, no.
No,
they were on that they were on the little bike thingies with the that flew.
Not in any of the chases. It was like they were just using it for utility or something. Jeez, don't make me go back and rewatch it.
Now, wait a minute. We got to go to the middle sections. They did have all those vehicles on... I think it was wherever Princess or Queen Amidala was. All of those things had funky wheels on them.
Oh, they did?
So, yeah, like all of the water people. Huh. I can't think of their name right now. My brain.
Oh, well, if it's in the prequels, it doesn't count, yes. In my opinion.
Okay, so they're just because they were rolling all over the place, and they had them in their fight scenes with the Clone Wars. There were rolling vehicles all over the Clone Wars.
But were they self-powered or were they animal drawn?
No, there were some of them were self-powered, I believe.
I'm going to have to go look this up because
Okay. Because
I swear the only motor-powered wheel-driven vehicle that I can remember is the Sandcrawler that the Jawas, you know, the big thing that they kidnapped when they originally kidnapped C-3PO and R2-D2.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I think there are others, but in the prequels, which are different anyway.
Right.
It's not like wheels are an expensive special effect to do or anything, though.
No, but they're decidedly not futuristic.
There is that, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't know. You know, the other side of that is wheels are decidedly universal. There's really no getting around them, even for technology.
Sure.
So, anyway. All right. Let's wrap this episode with the answer to our grand trivia auto question. The question, of course, was, what was the first Japanese car to be produced in the United States? Was it the Toyota Camry, the Honda Civic, the Nissan Altima, the Honda Accord, or the Subaru WRX? Anybody want to go first?
Honda Accord.
Honda Accord by Ben. Ben, you got any logic for that? Any reason?
Well, I've seen one in the Henry Ford Museum that was made in 1983 that claimed to be the first Japanese vehicle to roll off a U.S. assembly line.
Oh, that's interesting. So that may just be the answer right there then. What do you think, Don? Agreeable?
It doesn't matter. I hate Japanese cars.
Wow.
Sorry. I'm going to make a blanket statement. I have only owned one and I will never own them again. So
weren't you ogling a Lexus just a second ago?
No, I wasn't ogling it. I was just like, it's a interesting convertible first look of that LC500, but I wouldn't own it. Never. I wouldn't even, it's an interesting look. That's all. It's again, got that big grill in the front. Like this is a trend here.
Yeah.
Beefy front grills. The other Lexus IS has it too. but no, I wasn't ogling it. I was just making a commentary.
What do you think, Becca?
Well, I'm splitting hairs in my head again because the earliest Civic was also still an Accord. It was the Accord CVCC, which became the Civic. Because I feel like I want to say that one, but because that one was technically an Accord, I guess I will go with Honda Accord.
So you're right about the CVCC, which eventually became the Civic, but the answer is the Honda Accord. So in November of 1982, the first American-produced Honda Accord rolled off the assembly line at the Marysville Auto Plant in Ohio, making it the first Japanese car to be produced in the U.S. The Accord would prove to be quite popular in its first year of production. It became the best-selling Japanese car in the United States, a title that it hung on to for the next 15 years. So
And that first one is a nice little four-door with an automatic transmission, and I think it's that light metallic blue color that 80% of 80s Hondas were painted.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I've got a picture of it somewhere in my phone.
So my mom had one of the CVCCs. It was a silver hatchback CVCC, which had a semi-automatic transmission. You started off in one, you pushed it into second, and then you pushed it into D.
Okay.
It was the weirdest thing, yeah.
Well, if you want to know something really weird about me, when I was 15, 16, looking for my first car, I had two things that I wanted. I either wanted a Jeep, so a Wrangler type Jeep, or I wanted a 1981 Honda Accord CVCC. So it was basically kind of like a little bug car. You know, it was the two door, and it's got the rounded back instead of the sedan type like the Accord, and it's got the dual round headlights, and I thought they were just the cutest things in the world, but my dad was grumping, oh, you know, there's not going to be a foreign car in my driveway, blah, blah. So I almost started out with a Honda Accord if I could have gotten one, but I ended up, my mom found it in a lot, and I ended up buying my 1983 Mustang GLX.
And that's how it all got started.
And that's how it began.
So this, I can imagine your life being very different. Like, what if you had actually gone the Japanese car route in spite of what your family said? Instead of having a G8 and a Jeep in your driveway, you might have, I don't know, a RAV4 and I don't know, something, I'm drawing a blank now on what the other SUV types are, but
I don't know, would I have made better life choices as well?
Good question.
I guess that begs the question.
If you've gone down the Japanese car road, I do not believe that has any, it's in the world of statistics. It may be correlated, but it's not causation.
I'm pretty sure that there are plenty of folks out there who drive Japanese cars who make other terrible life choices as well.
Oh, yes. Kind of swinging back around to Star Wars, but car-related.
Yeah.
I've got a friend of mine who, he's been really wanting a Durango, and there's been a good crop of newer Durangos hanging out by where I live, and they all seem to be white, and they have this black detail. And I swear to you, I'm not kidding, they look like stormtroopers.
Oh, interesting.
The new Durangos in the white with black detail. It's like, oh, that is a stormtrooper.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the last Grand Trivia Auto question I have in my personal files to share. So if there are any listeners who have trivia that they'd like to have us talk about on the show, please send it to us via our website, thethingaboutcars.com, or find us on Facebook. I think it's simply facebook.com/thethingaboutcars, where you can send us a direct message. And if we use your trivia items, we'll definitely be giving you a shout on the show. In the meantime, I guess that's it for this episode. Yeah, hope everybody out there is safe and healthy. And we'll see you with another episode in about a week. Take care.
Bye.
Later on.
See ya.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.